This is Robert Rogers from Parkinson's Recovery, and I want to welcome each and every one of you who have signed in at this quite exciting teleseminar today. It's my total pleasure and delight to introduce Nancy Welsh. Nancy is a mental health counselor from Bellingham, Washington, who will be coming out with a book this spring entitled Meditation and Medicine. And Nancy is going to have the privilege of introducing our very prestigious guest today. Thanks, Nancy.
Yeah, hello, Roger. Thank you for that introduction. And yes, hello, Lee. I'd like to introduce you to everybody out there. This is I'm introducing Dr. Lee Nelson, who is a world-renowned researcher in the area of, perhaps you could put it better, Lee, but I'm going to say rheumatology and scleroderma at the cellular level. You are working out of the Fred Hutchinson Center at UW. And did I get that right?
Okay. Yeah. The only thing that Robert didn't get right is the prestige all goes to Nancy.
Yeah, right.
And I'm being truthful there. we really began our work in autoimmunity, scleroderma and rheumatoid arthritis. But it's turned out that it has much broader implications for a lot of different aspects of human health, and including some issues related to neurological disease, although it's not something that we've looked at in relationship to Parkinson's.
Mm-hmm. But you could see future application at some point as you continue to research.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not only a researcher and a scientist, you've also been meditating for quite a long time, 18, 20 years, is that correct?
I'm more like 30.
30 years?
Yep.
I didn't want to give your age away, but, oh, well. She started.
Okay, as a jazz musician I was listening to a month ago said, it's good to be along for the ride. So getting older is just fine, too.
So you have been meditating in both the Vipassana and the Zen tradition, is that correct?
Yes, predominantly in the Zen tradition. I first found someone who could give me my initial instruction when I was in when I began medical school, which was in about 1974. And I've kept up that practice and also sit with a Vipassana group, which is. For those people who might be listening that don't know, it could be a very long explanation about differences, but it's less, it's a bit more secularized form of meditation and Buddhism, a bit more popular for probably in, lay people than Zen, but Zen is my primary tradition.
Right, thank you for that. I should have explained that. Yes, Vipassana is... comes out of that original insight or Indian meditation and has been more popular here in the West than Zen, which is a more structured Japanese tradition. So thank you for making that distinction. I'd like to ask you a couple questions about linking together your meditation practice and your science practice. And one of the questions I'd like to ask is, do you think your meditation influences your medical research efforts to advance and maybe develop new treatment approaches to chronic illness?
Yeah, I think there's just absolutely no question about it. Although I didn't begin meditation with the purpose of, deliberately trying to do something for my career, it's impossible not to notice that a lot of the synthesis of things that just kind of fall into place and come together seem to happen, either, after meditating or during meditating, or I can kind of see there's an aspect to the practice that is very opening and allowing. And so once I've done the work of studying up on this, that, and the other thing, often when I just walk away from it or have been meditating, all of a sudden it comes into focus how things are connected. So I actually see a lot of the insights that I've had that have really helped us out a lot have really been not very deliberately generated by me. They've been more a result of, yes, I did the work, but then it was an aspect of being open that helped me kind of put the pieces of the puzzle together.
I see. So with meditation, it's almost like as you clear your mind, it leaves room for those insights to appear when they're ready.
That's really well said, Nancy. That's really well said. Because we live in a culture where we tend to think that the more we cram in, the better. But, in fact, having time to be quiet, and it's the same thing in science and medicine in meetings. You know, I think it's unfortunate when every single second of the day is crammed with some kind of informational session. Because a lot of times the putting things together and the creative thoughts and the breakthroughs come when people just sit down together and they have some space and they've been able to digest what they've heard and they start thinking together. Thinking together and just allowing, allowing the hearing of what the other person has to say too, so in a deeper way.
Yes, absolutely. This question, I don't mean to be repetitive, but it might dovetail or maybe a little more specific, but I know that some of the biological findings that you and others have made, for example, the finding that we harbor cells called, cellular chimerism. We harbor cells in our body derived from other individuals, such as our parents, for years or even over a lifetime. And it just seems very interesting in terms of what you've been talking about, the interconnectedness of things that come together in your mind when you've been meditating. And I'm just wondering if, you want to comment a little bit more on that. I find that fascinating that we truly are connected to all the people that have come before us in a way, if we actually carry their cells with us and pass them on.
Yeah, thank you again. It's also a really good question. So for anybody who's listening probably most people don't really know about this. It's a relatively new area of medical research. But we've known now since about the mid-1990s that a small number of cells transfer back and forth between a mother and child during pregnancy. And the surprise was that a small number of those cells, they must be stem cells, because 10, 20, 30, and even 40 years later, you can find them. So if a woman has had a son, you could draw her blood, and if you looked hard enough, you could show a male cell in there, even if her son is grown. And in an adult male, if you look hard enough, you can show a female cell derived from his mother. So it's really interesting to me that on a biological way we're more connected, than perhaps we used to think we were. And what happened is we got into this area of work because we were focused on a disease where we thought the cells might be doing something bad, being problematical, fetal cells in women with scleroderma. But overwhelmingly, probably the balance of the equation is that they do all kinds of good things because they're there in healthy individuals. And so now the field has really opened up. And again, because we're talking, to people who are interested in a neurological problem, Parkinson's disease, there are two experimental models at this point that do show that these cells do get into the brain. So, the mother cells get into at least the baby mouse brain, and the fetal cells get into the mother's mouse's brain. And so, again, I think the emphasis really should be on what they do that's good, but there are probably other circumstances where they may be part of the problem, and those are the autoimmune diseases that we study. I really don't know because I'm a medical internist in my training, not a neurologist. So I really don't know very much at all about Parkinson's, but if I were going to place a bet there just from what limited knowledge I have, I would ask, might they actually play a protective role or could they potentially be healing?
Wow, that would
I'd put it on the beneficial side if I were going to be researching their role and the potential for their role in Parkinson's.
Just to clarify something for the audience in case they also don't know, since I have arthritis, I'm very familiar with the different forms of arthritis, and scleroderma is actually considered a form, I believe, of arthritis. Could you just define that a little bit for our audience?
Yes, there are many, many different kinds of arthritis, and some of them are based on the immune system being out of balance. So those are the ones that I study. So they're called autoimmune. So rheumatoid arthritis can affect anyone from childhood all the way up to old age. And it has a real spectrum. It can be mild, but it can be quite severe as well. And that's believed to be mediated by the immune system being essentially out of balance. But there are other kinds of arthritis that aren't thought to be autoimmune, like they're caused by crystal deposition, such as gout, for example, or they're caused by just old age and degenerative change, like osteoarthritis, many forms of osteoarthritis. So what I know the most about is the autoimmune ones, just because that's my interest.
Right, and scleroderma is, could you describe that?
Yes, it's also an autoimmune disease. And autoimmune, what that means is the immune system mistakenly thinks its own normal body is foreign or there's something wrong with it and attacks its own normal tissues. There's no indication that there's actually anything wrong with the joint at all before the immune system starts getting active and making a lot of inflammation against it. And scleroderma also is thought to be this kind of autoimmune disease, but its hallmark feature is thickening of the skin, but then that same kind of thickening moves to the internal organs, so it can be a life-threatening disease.
Right, it's considered, yes, more deadly than rheumatoid.
Certainly we have fewer treatment options. There's a limited form of the disease where people do quite well, and even the diffuse form of the disease were better than we were 10 years ago, but we still don't have the kind of treatments that we'd like to have. So I think there we're a kindred spirit with Parkinson's, because there are treatments for Parkinson's, but of course, people would like there to be much more and better treatments, and really we'd all like to see a cure, of course.
Sure. I know many people hope that stem cell research, once it really takes off, could eventually help or even heal their condition, and since you certainly studied at the cellular level, I'm just wondering if you could comment on that. You know, does stem cell research look like it's going in that direction of actually being able to help even an adult who has a chronic illness such as Parkinson's, rheumatoid arthritis, et cetera, could stem cell research help in any way at some point in the future, do you think?
Yeah. I would put, as a guessing person, I would put a lot of hope there. We have... both Europe and the United States have programs where they're actually using what you could call stem cell transplant to treat some of these very severe forms of autoimmune diseases. So, for example, both multiple sclerosis and scleroderma in a severe form, people that have a very poor prognosis are actually on protocols where they have a stem cell transplant. And what the stem cell transplants do, the usual form, what's most often done, is they're called autologous, which is a word that simply means that what's done is they take, a lot of your cells out of you, and then they enrich them for stem cells. And at the time they're enriching for stem cells, they're essentially getting rid of a lot of the kind of active immune cells, the cells that, presumably have caused the problem. And then they give a lot of treatment to get rid of the remaining bad immune cells and then reinfuse this enriched stem cells of yours. And the hope has been, and the theory has been, that you may then, even as adults, when you repopulate from these enriched stem cells of yours, you won't repopulate that bad clone of cells or those bad clones, plural, of cells that cause the disease. And I have to say that, you know, when this all began, I think one of the original conferences looking into it as a possibility for some of these severe diseases like multiple sclerosis, you know, I was among the doubters. I thought, you know, this is not going to work. But actually the results out of Europe and out of the U.S. Look pretty good. So there are a lot of people that get prolonged remission from their disease by that kind of a procedure. It's, of course, a very serious undertaking. I mean, it's, you know, having a stem cell transplant is you know, it's a big deal.
It sounds very exciting, though, and I, of course, having an autoimmune disease myself, the first question is, wow, where can I get that treatment? But what you're saying is it's very limited. It's very
well, it's on protocols across the U.S. For example, for scleroderma, there is a multi-center trial. So there are multiple centers across the U.S. that are doing these transplants for scleroderma patients. I would guess the same must be true for multiple sclerosis, although I'm not as aware of I only know of one particular center myself. And I know that it has been considered, although less so, for very severe rheumatoid arthritis. I have not personally heard of that particular approach for Parkinson's disease, but then I don't really read about Parkinson's disease since I'm not a neurologist. But I know certainly stem cell treatment has been considered for a host of neurological diseases and, you know, as holding a lot of hope.
Yeah, not to get into a political imbroglio, but, you know, I've certainly heard various politicians and different factors and factions in the population say, oh, stem cell research is bad. It's against nature, against God's will. Have you run into any of that in your reading, or is it no longer considered, you know, something, you know, scary and bad by certain people in the population of Europe and the U.S.?
You know, there's no easy answer there. I haven't, because it's not a subject that's come up for me in our work. Everything that we do is based on human studies, but none of it is based on the kind of controversial issues related to stem cell research.
I guess I'd be talking more about fetal cell, probably.
I mean, I you know, I think each individual person just has to deal with what they are personally comfortable with. And I, you know, I actually don't know if it came up for me that I could see the way to make a huge difference for a lot of people, and yet, you know, there would be an embryo sacrificed. You know, I would have to actually just sit and meditate with that. And my guess would be I would come out of the side of, you know, that just by living, we try to do as little harm as possible. But, you know, every time we step outside, I mean, we're stepping on this, that, and the other thing. So harm is done, and look for the better good, and just weigh those two. But it hasn't come up for me. But I know people feel very passionately about it. So I guess, you know, I have to respect, you know, everybody's feelings there, and of course I'm going to be pro making progress to decrease human suffering if that's at all possible.
Right, and that brings me to another question that I think you and I have talked about in the past, and that is the scientific dialogue between animal model and human model experimental studies, especially you know, being being a Buddhist and with the you know, the caveat of, you know, do not kill, and also having been in graduate school an experimental psychologist myself, you know, I was a participant in harming rats during some of our researches, and at the time, I wasn't very aware of practicing Buddhism, and it seemed like, well, this is just science. Since then, it's really struck me as, whoa, these are sentient beings, and we're disposing of them as if they were, you know, inanimate objects. And I know you've had some strong feelings about human versus animal models, not just because of Buddhism, but also because of what can be learned. Is that correct? Could you comment on that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I have to share with you, that's a very sweet story that came up probably about 10 years ago. There was a researcher who really did a very elegant mouse model for scleroderma. And he was a younger guy than me, and I met him at a meeting, and he was going up to give a big talk, and so I was trying to kind of, you know, give him a pep talk because he was kind of scared to talk in public. And he looked at me. I just asked him how it was going and everything. But at this point, he was getting older, even though he was younger than me. And he said, you know, the older I get, the harder it is for me to kill these mice. It was just very sweet because, like he was saying, as he continually recognized his own mortality, it wasn't the same for him anymore.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, there's just no doubt that huge advances have been made by working in experimental models. But there's also no doubt that it is killing, you know, if that's what the experiment calls for, you know, a living being. And I personally would like to see scientists, you know, at least if they feel that is the only way they can answer a question and the best way, and that it really has true hope for something very worthwhile, to be extremely respectful of that and not to try to claim it's not there, not to try to claim, like you said, you know, that these are just inanimate objects and there isn't suffering.
Okay.
So, yes, there's not suffering the way humans suffer, but clearly there's suffering. I mean, we you know, any of us who have, you know, dogs and cats and have had to lose our dog and cat recognize that.
Right. Yeah, I like that idea. I know I've learned or read somewhere where in the old Native American traditions, when they would have to kill an animal to feed themselves, to feed the family, they honor and thank the animal for giving them its life so that their lives can continue. And when I think back, you know, to the graduate lab where I worked and how cavalier we were with these mice, you know, I wish I could go back and say, you know, thank you for sacrificing yourself, for allowing us to find out. At the time, we were looking at the effects of the different effects of alcohol on different systems in the body. You know, this was many years ago, and I know many animals have been sacrificed for me and for my medicines over the years. I know each time a new medicine comes out, somewhere along the line, some animal has been somehow made to have my disease and then experimented on with the medicine. Is that correct to say? Is that kind of how animal models work? They induce an illness and then try to cure it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole spectrum, of course, of experimental work. There's some that are just designed to try to understand what causes the disease, and there are others designed to try treatments or interventions.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, I think that's a good summary. And yeah, I appreciate what you said also about just adopting that as an attitude, the same kind of attitude as the Native Americans, you know, which is to be respectful and not to be cavalier, at least.
Right.
Yeah.
If we were to move more to human models, what would that be like? I mean, do you think people would volunteer to to try something very, very new and that may be risky. Have you asked for humans to volunteer for you to try things?
Well, we, you know, we don't have, I don't personally have, like, treatment trials. So everything that we have done so far is trying to actually discover, you know, what actually causes, the real root cause of some of these diseases. But I think that lay organizations and, you know, the person, you know, a non-medical person can play a very huge role. Because I personally think there's a tendency for scientists to migrate towards experimental models because it's so much easier.
You mean with animals? Or?
So much more. There's so much more that's in your control if
sure.
you do that. So you order a particular mouse strain. You can do this, that, and the other thing, etc. But the problem arises, particularly for the kind of things I study, which is, well, how applicable really is that to humans? And so I try to start from the position of, can I ask the question I want an answer to in studies of humans? And it's not easy, but it's doable. So there are things you can do just by looking at blood, and people are willing to give blood samples. There are things you can do, you know, if people have had a biopsy done for a clinical reason. Like sometimes, for example, in a liver disease, they don't know what kind of liver disease it is, so they do a biopsy. Well, there's always a little left over. So then they're willing to say, well, I donate the leftover so that people can do research. It can make a huge difference because then you can actually look in the species that you're trying to help. And you don't have to have that question of, you know, am I going to spend 5 or 10 years working on this, and then anything I figure out is not going to, you know, be applicable to humans. So I think, you know, there's a beautiful model that was being set up a number of years ago in Germany and is happening where the government was actually funding a research group and also a lay activist group, you know. So, for example, it would be, you know, the Parkinson's Association, you know, one of the associations. So they would support the whole spectrum of people so they could work together. And I think then you really have a good chance of moving things forward kind of in our lifetimes to try to figure out what's going on with some of these diseases.
Yeah,
I'm being more long-winded than I wanted to be. I don't get to ask you any questions.
This is fascinating. I know I made that joke about, you probably didn't hear it because I overran you, but I know I've certainly donated blood to you, and you've also gathered DNA from my mother to look for your research, as you have, I'm sure, from many other, generations.
Yes, and there's really not much risk in that. I mean, you know,
right.
Some people don't like to have their blood drawn, but, I mean, it's not like it's a big risky procedure. So, and you really can find out a lot and really
right.
appreciate it. And often you find that, you know, family members of people with the disease are just really motivated. They you know, it makes their heart happy to try to do something.
Oh,
so,
my mom's still waiting for me to find a cure for me, so...
Yeah.
Hurry up. She was very excited to do that. She didn't realize that all I have to do is take a swab in my mouth and...
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely become easier. The DNA technology has made a lot of this a lot easier. I used to, when I started out, the DNA technology wasn't here, and we needed to also study children. So you can imagine what that's like, trying to talk a child into giving a blood sample. Not
oh,
so
yeah.
easy.
I certainly remember that from my own childhood, yes.
There you go.
Yeah. I know Robert has sent a question from one of his listeners, and I'm not sure if you can speak to this because I know it's not your area, but I'd like to just throw it out there and see what you have to say. It comes from Menorah Miller of Denver, Colorado, and she's interested in whether... certain kinds of fastings can rid the body of toxins that perhaps exacerbate disease, whether it be Parkinson's, arthritis, whatever, and are eating certain sort of live, healthy sprouts, again, a way of detoxifying the body, and does that help in the serious diseases such as Parkinson's and scleroderma, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question, and I have just no idea. I mean, I would have my ears, you know, tuned in and be very open to what other people's experience are. So, now, we aren't, we can't turn this around and ask Robert Rogers if he could comment on that, can we?
Hey, Robert, I know you're there.
Well, not many people with Parkinson's tell me that fasting gives them profound relief. The difficulty is it can be a rather aggressive intervention, particularly if fasting for a person means not really ingesting any food, or rather they're just drinking basically water. The difficulty is that the detoxing can come very quickly, and that can put a significant strain on a body that's already struggling. So the key really is not necessarily in the specific approach that people take, but rather in doing it tenderly and gently, so that there's enough time that's allotted for the body to be able to do the natural work of ridding the toxins and noxious substances. So that particular question focuses in on one particular approach. There are many different others that we've learned about through interviews with naturopaths. There are a lot of ways to detox. And I think the key is for a person to do a little of experimentation and see which one seems to work the best for them. The problem with the fasting approach is, or the potential problem is, that it may be too aggressive, and the person begins to feel so poorly that they're really not able to function at all. But it clearly is an option, and it's something that a person can experiment with and see if it works for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've certainly heard of eliminating like one food group at a time to see if that affects one's health. That's certainly been recommended to me in many different ways over the years. So I guess that's what you would mean when you say gently, perhaps removing just one or two food groups at a time to see if there's any effect, and then if not, try another one, kind of process.
Very slowly and gradually. Yeah, and there may be, of course, some allergic reactions there that could be identified in that with that approach as well.
Right. Lee, as a scientist, do you think that this has been asked of me a lot because so many people, when they just even get to know me a little bit and realize the extent of my arthritis, that, you know, they really want to help, and they've offered many, many different ideas that they've heard of, and one, of course, is this is a food allergy, and if you could just find the right diet, you're going to feel better, perhaps even knock this out of your system. Now, I have certainly tried those more natural ways and haven't had much success myself, but I'm just wondering if you have any experience with that, you know, of autoimmune diseases being related at all to food allergies or any kind of allergy, I guess, that would exacerbate the condition. It seems to me it's more genetic, but I hear from so many people that, well, no, try this or try that. And I guess, could you comment a little bit on that, or are they just grasping at straws because they want to help me?
I mean, we pray, really, you know, for anything that we could do that's in our control to change these difficult illnesses with which we struggle. And so, you know, I mean, there's a place to have, you know, hope, because you can change what you eat.
Mm-hmm.
But in a disease like rheumatoid arthritis, at least, it seems unlikely that it's going to be a big answer for any majority of people, because it's a disease that's absolutely worldwide. You know, so it affects populations everywhere, you know, Africa, Japan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So
it's hard to start to get to a presumption that this would be major. But the disease, most of these diseases, at least the ones I work on, are actually a spectrum. And so there's something we call rheumatoid arthritis, but there's within that there's a lot of diversity. So maybe somewhere within that there's a small population of people, you know, or a few people where, you know, there is some effect that they see. And even if there's something that you see you can do that is in your control to do, even if it helps a little bit, you know, that's a nice thing to have. So it's not unreasonable to work with and to, you know, to try, you know, as long as it's not something that's otherwise harmful.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't personally put a lot of stake in hoping that it would be curative or be actually a major a major modulating factor.
I remember from my research thesis way back in 1984, reading in the American Psychological Association Journal an article on that issue of control that people, now these scientists were looking at cancer patients, and when the cancer patients took the, in a sense, the control of what they put in their bodies, it didn't necessarily prolong their life or get rid of the cancer, but their quality of life or reported quality of life improved dramatically. And what the scientists were saying is the issue of personal control over one's body and over one's illness has a lot to do with one's quality of life, how one feels about how they're living and how they're coping with their disease. And, you know, I was very, very impressed with that. Certainly incorporated into my thesis, and I guess that's what you were talking about, that people, it's not just grasping at straws, it's really trying to find a sense of there's something I can do to help myself, I'm not passive, I'm not completely reliant on somebody else to fix me.
Yeah, and I feel like maybe I sounded a little too more pessimistic really than I am there. Really, my bent is to try to find, you know, really effective treatment and or cure for some of these diseases.
Oh, absolutely.
But at the same time, I mean, I would say the same thing. I mean, even for, you know, somebody like me who doesn't have arthritis, I mean, it's very clear that eating certain ways, I feel a lot better than eating other ways. And so why not try to tune in to your specifics? And it's always kind of individual. You know, to what makes your day better. What I'm saying, I guess, is, you know, I do think it's worth our attention. It's just for the majority of people in terms of actually finding kind of really effective treatment and eventually a cure for this disease, it doesn't seem real likely that we'd be able to do that simply through diet.
Right.
Given the commonness of rheumatoid arthritis and given its worldwide distribution across so many different cultures.
And, Robert, would you say that's true with Parkinson's, too, that it is worldwide?
Yeah.
Can I piggyback a question? Not only is it worldwide, but have you found in working with Parkinson's people that when they feel they have more control over what they're doing about their illness, do they feel sort of more empowered or you know, an improved quality of life? Have you noticed, or do you have any comments on that?
I definitely have. For the many, many people that I talk with and formally interview, anybody who takes control over their situation and begins to take positive action in their daily habits with regard to what they put into their bodies, how active they are with respect to exercise, how they challenge their minds so that they can improve those neural networks, basically taking control for themselves, what we find is people are feeling better. They do see relief in their symptoms. As Dr. Nelson points out, people are not reporting any kind of instant cures. The symptoms do not vanish magically. But people who pursue this find that over the years, they really do quite well.
And our original idea for this book was to look at helping Parkinson's and other chronic illness patients take a look at meditation as perhaps a way of helping cope with their illness, not cure it, certainly, but coping or finding, again, an improvement in the quality of their life. And I think, Lee, what you've said is that meditation for you clears your mind, open it up for the insights you can then use in your research. And do you think it's reasonable for people who are physically uncomfortable, to sit zazen or to sit in the typical meditative postures? Many of us can't do that. Can we still use meditation as a way to cope with our illness and perhaps feel that sense of clarity of thought and hopefulness or whatever comes through one's meditation?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just invaluable because when you feel badly, at least for me, there's just a tendency to totally identify with that, so that you feel that all there is the suffering.
Mm-hmm.
But, regardless of how you sit, even if you're lying down because you're really not feeling well, but meditating, it opens up a freedom and an understanding, and you get an intuitive knowledge that there is more than the suffering. So you have a certain kind of detachment from the suffering. And so I just think it's hugely valuable. It's been the most valuable thing for my life. It did not necessarily make my life totally easier. So, example, when I was in my medical training, as I said, right when I went to medical school, I learned how to meditate. So the mind would think, well, okay, and everything's going to be hunky-dory and it's going to be easier. Well, there's no question but that I would, that I would make that choice again and again, and that it really did wonderful things. I could be in a very difficult situation with somebody in intensive care unit and, just distraught families and someone dying. And I feel like I could hear what was being said much more clearly, and my heart was there with people. But at the same time, my sensitivity was there. So it did not allow me, as you said, with the rats, to be cavalier. It didn't allow me to kind of block things out. So even though it's I regard it as hugely valuable, it doesn't give an immunity to caring about other people's suffering, really an immunity to your own, but it I think shows you some freedom beyond that suffering, and that gives a lot of strength.
You're sort of accepting the suffering just as it is without adding a whole lot more.
Yeah, there's where I need you to kind of articulate that better. That's where I was trying to go, and maybe you could say a little more there, because, yeah, that's the kind of thing I mean.
I certainly had that experience, too, of feeling almost overly sensitive at times as I grew in my meditation practice, that I almost felt a bit raw for a little while, until, of course, it is important, I think, with if you're really going to dive into meditation seriously, that you do work with someone who's been doing it or a teacher. So when you hit that, if you hit that bump in the process where you almost feel like you're overwhelmed with sensitivity and compassion for the world so much that you're almost paralyzed by it, that's your meditation is, you know, sort of needs to be brought back, you know, to your center, to only what you can do, what you can be open to, what you can do to help, but that you can't, it's not going to make you open to helping everything or solving everything and fixing everything, that but you are going to have much more openness and much more presence with whatever you're doing and whoever you're working with. And of course in the helping professions, that's very important, to be present without being overwhelmed by someone else's suffering.
Yes, so that's a place where also I think, you know, you had brought up this subject in another conversation we had. It's just the importance of the caregiver. Because mm-hmm. oftentimes, I mean, it's just so difficult on the caregiver. I mean, you feel almost even more helpless
mm-hmm.
because, you know, you love this person and what can you do, and you want to make it better and you can't make it better. So having a meditation practice, I think, can be really helpful there too.
Yes, I feel that meditation kind of strips away all the extra stuff that comes with suffering. You know, the judgment of suffering, the fear of suffering, the "gee, why me? This is no fair" suffering. Instead, it's sort of, you can just look at it as, okay, yes, this is suffering, and everyone suffers. We can live with it without, as you say, letting it define it ourselves, that's only a part of ourselves, and that for me has brought a lot more clarity and calmness around my suffering than I've ever had before. You know, I often, as a younger person, would say, you know, shake my fist, "Why me, God?" You know, and now it's just like, well, why not me? And it just happens. It's just life, and one accepts what is. And when you get to that place, it's an amazing kind of calmness and clarity. And the pain's still there. It's just not as frightening.
Yeah, but thank you. That's really well said. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Robert, do you have any, or do your listeners have any more questions for Lee?
I do have some more. Yes. Sally from Boston asks, what would be a helpful visual to hold while meditating?
You know, I think this is a wonderful question. I'm gonna volley it to Nancy, because she's really the therapist here. But I just want to say that from my own personal experience, there was a real rough patch that I went through recently. And my sister is also a therapist, and she had a very specific visualization and some other kind of exercises, you know, that she's over the years accumulated, that she suggested, you know, things that were particular to my situation, to say, you know, okay, take 10 minutes and say this, you know, and, you know, and you know, ground yourself, sit down, you know, go out for a walk so that you're not totally in your head. And she knows me well. and they were just hugely valuable. So maybe Nancy can say something about that. But I know in my experience that it was, you know, that what helped me the most was specific to me. You know, was just specific to the kind of struggles I was going through at the time. Nancy?
I know in my Zen practice, my goal is to try to not focus too much on anything, to let thoughts, visualizations, ideas, feelings just pass through my mind. My teacher, Norman Fisher, uses the example as, your mind is like the sky and your thoughts are clouds, just let them go. But that's only one way of meditation. There's other ways that, and I've worked with some of my therapy patients this way, where you do actually focus on, you know, an idea or a picture of yourself as you know, being calm, being relaxed, perhaps, you know, visualize a setting, especially for very anxious people. I work with a lot of anxiety disorders. And having a guided kind of meditation where they put themselves in a place where they feel safe and warm and relaxed, that really, you know, once they get the hang of that, they can take themselves there when they need to, when the anxiety starts to hit or the panic attack starts to hit. And it is very individual. You know, each person has their own sort of special idea or place that they can put themselves in where they feel more relaxed. And that's what I call sort of guided meditation. And I do that, I don't have a set formula other than to work, you know, back and forth with my patient to see what works for them. It's a little bit of hypnosis. You know, you do certainly, you know, help them relax. I kind of use going down the stair steps one at a time until you're at the bottom. And then what do you see when you open the door? And that's when they can start visualizing their safe place where they can go and relax. And that's more for, like I say, anxiety disorders, but it can also be used for when you're just overwhelmed with your own pain, illness, personal, you know, problems, whatever. I think it is a kind of meditation. It's not exactly Zen, but I think it's very helpful for people who are suffering. And so I can't really say visualize this or that. It would have to be what you feel, what you individually feel is the safest, calmest, warmest, you know, just most beautiful thought you can imagine and put yourself in there and relax into it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, and that was, you know, I remember also similar, my sister said is, you know, you go down step by step, 10 steps, and then expressing, you know, what would you see or what kind of a, you know, that would make you feel extreme, you know, very comfortable, and then having it come actually from that person. You know, the other thing I like, though, and I don't do this very much, but I like the Vipassana tradition of where they say, you know, may I be well, may I be safe, may I be happy, may I be at ease, may I be peaceful, may I be filled with loving kindness, or any one or combination of those. And then also saying that for other people, you know, may, you know, my spouse be at ease, may my spouse be happy, you know, may he be at peace, may he be maybe well, and that's not visual, but it's another kind of, you know, not really a mantra, but it's another thing that can be said that can be very comforting in difficult times.
That's a perfect lead-in to the next question from Toby from Boston, who says, I have a hard time meditating, but I daily say a healing mantra in a quiet time. Does that accomplish the same goal?
Oh, you know, I just love this question, because I have to say that if I were born in the current era, there's no question they would have diagnosed me with ADD, so the attention deficit disorder. So, Toby, I really relate to, I really relate to you. I'm easily distracted and easily flighting off, and it was not easy for me to meditate. And it's not really a matter of jealousy, but I watch other people who just sit down and, you know, 20, they say, well, what's the problem? You know, they can just sit down and be quiet and focus and have no trouble. So, yes, I think, you know, having a healing mantra is great. We're diverse people, and some of us are a little more hyperactive than others. What do you think, Nancy?
I absolutely agree. I think just taking even, you know, three, 5 minutes to say in your head or out loud, if you're comfortable with it, to say the positive things, you know, like you were talking about the loving kindness meditation, or whatever the mantra is that makes you feel most at peace. I do believe that is that can be very comforting and very healing in terms of coping. And I think that's what the gist of all of these interviews, you know, this book is about, not necessarily curing or ridding yourself of your suffering, but coping with it in a different way that isn't so painful. And if the mantra works, and it needs to be I think it needs to be very personal to the individual. I think it's a beautiful, beautiful way to go about it. Sitting still and clearing your mind isn't the only way to meditate. There are many, many ways. And so I agree, Toby. I think that's a great thing.
Toby has a follow-up question. She says, as I mentioned in a previous question, I have a hard time meditating on my own. I have used relaxation and guided imagery CDs. As a matter of fact, I keep my CD player by my bed, and I use it when I can't sleep. And most times, it does the trick. The question is, am I receiving the same effect as just trying to meditate on my own?
You know, I just feel like I've got a kindred spirit out there in Toby. I can really relate. I sometimes do the same thing, you know, and listen to a CD. Sometimes I have difficulty sleeping, and it'll do the trick, too. I mean, yes, but at the point in time where, you know, life circumstances change and she finds that she's able to just sit quietly in a traditional way of meditating, she'll probably find that useful, too. So it sounds like she's navigated perfectly what works for her, and that's exactly what we all need to do in our, you know, for our current circumstances, because they keep changing, and sometimes you just can't, you know, one thing works and another one doesn't. But, you know, someday she'll be as old as me, and, you know, maybe she may find that other things work as well, so she may be adding. What do you think, Nancy?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that when you say traditional, again, it doesn't mean sitting in the typical, you know, Asian way where people are sitting, you know, full lotus like a pretzel. Traditional meditation can be done in a chair, lying down, you know, whatever's most comfortable. But I think what you're referring to is that sort of emptying your mind rather than putting something into it. However, depending on, I think, where a person is at the moment, if listening to those tapes helps you relax, gives your body comfort, gives your mind the time out it needs, then I think it's a beautiful thing. There are times when I use music to settle myself. There's times when I use my teacher's recordings, listening to his voice, listening to his talks, to recenter myself when I just feel like I'm flying apart, you know, that I've got so much to do, and oh my gosh, and I plug in a CD from Norman Fisher and remember, wait a minute, I do have the ability to pull myself back in and breathe and center. And so, yeah, I think it's a good thing. I think you're really, like Lee says, navigating your way the best, you know, what's best for you.
Yeah.
I think that's great.
You know, the one thing I would say, though, is it is extraordinarily easy to get caught, you know, when you're by yourself. And it really is useful to connect up with, you know, a friend or a small group or a teacher. And they're not going to be perfect either, you know.
Yeah.
So when you do that, you know, you'll discover, you know, the same kind of stuff that happens in the workplace, you know, that people, you know, regardless of what practice they're doing, have their imperfections too. But it really helps not getting stuck. So I think if there's a way to connect up to other people, it really helps. And actually, I find personally that I settle down and am a lot quieter, a lot faster sitting with a group than sitting by myself often. There's something about the cooperative effort that you feel, and you feel supported by it. So both in terms of not getting caught and in terms of, you know, added support, it's useful not to try to do it all on your own. Nancy, you agree with that?
Oh, I absolutely agree. And I do sit with a group and do feel, you know, much more somehow present with my meditation with a group. And I also remember something our teacher Norman said years ago. It's harder to get up when you're in the middle of a group of people sitting. So if you even have the urge to suddenly go, oh, poo, I'm done with this, it's harder just to get up and leave the room when you're with a group of people who are meditating. Where by yourself, who knows? You know, nobody's going to know I'm stopping 5 minutes into it and, you know, walking away from it. So the group, you know, not to have a punitive effect, it just has that supportive and support, you know, it'll support you sitting when I say sitting, I mean meditating in whatever way is comfortable. It does support you hanging in there with it a little bit longer because you're with other people who are trying to do the same thing, and it's a beautiful, beautiful feeling of group cooperativeness and support.
Yeah.
Any more questions, Robert?
Yes. This one actually comes from me. I every day get a large number of people who subscribe to the Parkinson's Recovery newsletter. But today I got one person who unsubscribed and said the following thing. They said, your newsletters have been very helpful. Thank you for the information, but it's all getting too complicated. I thought, I can really empathize with that. I keep talking with people. They come up with these different ideas, and they tell me, yes, this is helping, that's helping. Mm-hmm. You ought to try this, you ought to try that. I mean, we're up to a large number of approaches people can take to be able to get some relief from their symptoms. So it's overwhelming to me, too. My question really is the following. Would it be a better bet for people just to say, forget it, I'm just going to continue to do what I've been doing in my life, and I'm going to wait for a cure? You know, maybe stem cells will come out and fix me, but why do I need to bother with trying to figure out things I can do to help myself feel better?
I relate to the feeling of it's all too complicated, and I actually do a lot in my personal life to try to keep things simple because we're living in an age of information overload. And as a matter of fact, actually, there was a workshop recently on that exact subject, which was called Too Busy to Think. So much coming at us, we just don't have time. So I certainly relate to the sentiment. I don't really relate to checking out. I think I relate to cutting back rather than checking out, because everything changes. And, you know, I mean, that's the one thing we're sure of. So it's nice to have, you know, just to I guess, embrace our humanness. And the world of medical research is like this. I mean, there's just no way you can ever be caught up. It's always overwhelming. There's way too much to read and way too much to know. So to accept that and say, you know, I'm one human being, and I'm going to be able to do a certain amount, but there's no way I'll be able to understand all of this. And so I'll just do what I can and pay attention to our own bodies and our own minds and how we feel. Okay, was I trying to do too much? Or have I kind of felt despair and despondent? And is that why I'm turning away? And if that's the case, maybe I won't turn away because I know there is hope, but I just won't overwhelm myself with trying to think I've covered it all. Does that make some sense? And Nancy, do you want to comment again?
Oh, it makes absolute sense when you're, like I said, often throughout my life, people have, and I do believe out of a loving heart, they've offered me so many different solutions. I remember as a child once, my father made me drink vinegar because he heard that would help. And sometimes, you know, people, they just want to help, so they give you idea after idea after idea. And I used to get angry. I used to want to say, what do you know of my experience? Since really settling into my Zen practice, I see now that it does come from a loving place, but that doesn't mean I have to try it. That doesn't mean I have to agree with them and go do it. because otherwise I'd be doing possibly 30 different things a day that I've been told over the years would help. And instead, I just thank them and remember in my heart that it's a loving thing that they're doing, but I don't have to do it. And I don't have to put them down for trying to help me. So I could see getting overwhelmed. And you know, my response, of course, was to get angry because I used to be very defensive about my disease. I didn't want to talk about it. I didn't want people to notice it. And I certainly didn't want them to tell me what to do about it. And that's really changed through meditation. So, but I can relate to that feeling of being overwhelmed and maybe even, you know, just wanting to say, you know, chuck this stuff. I'm just going to wait and do what, you know, do what the doctor tells me. But I do believe in that if you're doing it because it feels right for you, then it becomes your process and you own it, and that's going to give you that sense of I'm doing what's best for me, and that's what I need to be doing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's – although I also agree, you know, checking out completely and becoming completely passive, I don't think helps one feel very empowered or very supported or strong. You know, in fact, you're sort of waiting for somebody else to pick you up sort of thing, and that's never been a good feeling for me. So I could see not going that far with it, but just taking what works and leaving the rest. That's kind of how I see it.
Yeah, but I mean, I trust Robert, this person, that's exactly what they need to do right now. That
mm-hmm.
they felt it in themselves, and that's what they need to do right now. And you know, who knows? Maybe in 6 months, maybe in a year, maybe in 2 years, it'll be okay. You know, now I want to tune back in. Maybe yes, maybe no. But and it sounds like it's really coming from a very, you know, just it's overwhelming, and it's time for them to step back. And we've all been there. And it's good to step back at times.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That'll be very helpful to them, I know. The people that I talk with Parkinson's generally fall into a rather fascinating profile. They have been extremely successful over the course of their careers and their lives. They've been active. They're movers and shakers. They're basically the people who are making things happen in the world, and then all of a sudden their bodies begin to shut down, and there begins to evolve some symptoms that are troubling, that can be painful. There can be a lot of suffering, and of course, extreme frustration because they can't make their bodies do what they want them to do in order to continue with the successes that they've had in their life in the past. What would you say to persons who have Parkinson's, given that you've got extensive experience in addressing individuals who have chronic diseases? What would you say to persons with Parkinson's that you would like for them to be sure and remember?
Nancy, do you want to answer that first?
Well, I certainly know what it's like to have my body not do what I want it to do when I want to go do something with it, and it is very frustrating. But I guess what I'd say is that, you know, it doesn't mean that what you've done in the past is invalidated, and it doesn't mean that you won't be able to continue to do something. You know, some of the things that you want to be doing is just you may have to cut back. You may have to do it in a slightly different way. You may have to accept that, you know, I've made a good contribution with my life so far, and now it's time maybe to step back and, you know, just give my body a rest. Again, you know, sort of learn to live with more limitations than I have before. But that doesn't invalidate what I've contributed. It doesn't invalidate what I can continue to contribute with my mind, with what I can communicate to other people.
And I mean, Robert, this is just what comes up for me, is just you're not alone. We're all heading there. They're just heading there on a time frame and with a problem that they never expected. But, you know, we're all heading to some form of disability and death eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really all face this in one way or the other, especially as we get older. And it is difficult in a society that tends to judge things by, well, what did you accomplish? But, you know, even just retiring after you've really been measuring things in a large part by what you could accomplish, even just retiring, okay, well, you know, well, what's the meaning to my life now? You know, I'm retired. I'm no longer making this contribution either to, you know, taking care of people, you know, as a counselor or as a medical professional or taking care of their legal problems or taking care of their household needs or their remodels or anything else. So really, we all share this. It's just a matter of time and when it happens. So it can't just be about what we get accomplished. It's kind of an obstacle of the mind. That's what the mind wants to judge us that way, that, you know, I'm worthwhile because of what I got done. But, I mean, I think we can all think of people who they're worthwhile to us, not because of what they got done. It's just, it's who they are. So I think it's maybe letting go of a little of the tyranny of the mind there that's trying to make a tally sheet and say what's worthwhile is accomplishment in a traditional way that we think about it. That makes sense?
I think that's well said, yes. Yes, that is. I do think we over-focus on accomplishment. Obviously, I was just doing that. And you're right. Accomplishment can, I mean, we think of it as somehow, you know, almost constructing something or leaving something huge, you know, behind with our name on it. And yet accomplishment can be just really opening your heart with loving kindness.
Yeah, it's, you know, and I totally share this with this person, too, because, you know, I mean, I'm basically afraid of retiring, you know, because I'm pretty, I have a good bit of this mind-centered, well, you know, what am I accomplishing? But recently I was reading, and it's in a very popular book, you know, by Eckhart Tolle, you know, and he talks about just waking up to, you know, the sound of a bird. And yeah, you can't put that on a score sheet, you know. But it's a whole other aspect of beauty in life and worthwhileness. I think that's the thing, you know, is that is worthwhile.
Absolutely. Well, realize we've been talking for about an hour. I'm just wondering if we're ready to kind of wrap things up. Are there any other questions?
Maybe just one more of Dr. Nelson. If there's anything that you thought about wanting to say during this discussion that you haven't said.
As a matter of fact, I've said more than I was planning. Usually I like to listen more than talk. It's been, you know, it's been a gift. I appreciate being invited to speak with the two of you and to turn my attention briefly to Parkinson's. Like I said, I'm an internal medicine doctor, and so neurology is a whole different specialty, and I really don't know much. But, you know, I did the thing most people do. I went to the Internet and read a little bit. And just kind of tuned in to what a problem it is and the kind of work that's being done and, you know, the kind of struggles that might come up with, you know, both the people that have Parkinson's and the people who are the caregivers for Parkinson's. So I appreciate the opportunity to think about these questions that people asked and to be able to talk with both you, Robert, and you know, especially always with Nancy.
Well, I have personally absolutely enjoyed this discussion. It's been quite revealing to me, and I thank you both for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you, Lee. It's been wonderful. You've really, you may think you talk too much, but I could listen to a whole lot more. But
me too.
Because I think you are really a brilliant and thoughtful, and I mean that in terms of that, you know, you really think about what you're doing and what other people are experiencing. And I just think you're a very incredible person, and I just am so grateful to be your friend as well as to have you agree to be interviewed for this project. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And thank you. Thank you, Robert.
Well, it's me to thank you, Lee.
Oh,
so
no.
At the teleseminar page, just a couple of announcements. At the bottom right, there's a link that says Parkinson's Recovery Membership. And for those of you that are looking at that on your computer screens, if you click on that, you're going to see a strange login panel. And what I want to invite you to do is to put in the username Recover, R-E-C-O-V-E-R, and the password READY, R-E-A-D-Y. And that'll take you into the Parkinson's Recovery member website, where you will, in just a couple of minutes, be able to get a full recording of this discussion. So if there are pieces that you want to listen to again, or if you'd like, if you missed part of it, either at the beginning or the end, you can hear the whole thing by simply clicking on the teleseminar recording. There's also a guided meditation specifically for Parkinson's there on cellular healing. So check that out. There are both short meditations that only last a couple of minutes, and then there's a longer meditation on cellular healing that lasts about 30 minutes. I also have the honor of having as a guest on a teleseminar on Monday at 12 noon Pacific time, that's 3 o'clock Eastern time, Carol Meenan. Carol is the senior advisor for newly diagnosed individuals for the Parkinson's Action Network. Parkinson's has been diagnosed with Parkinson's for almost 17 years and has had deep brain stimulation surgery about 2 years ago in February. And I'm quoting in an email from her, quote, "I am doing quite well." And so we're going to talk with her really about three subjects. One, her experience with Parkinson's, which is pretty longstanding, and what she's done to get great relief from her symptoms. Second, she's going to be talking about the Parkinson's Action Network Forum, 15th through the 17th of March, this March 2009 in Washington, D.C. They will be training individuals to become advocates of getting funding from the National Institute of Health for research on Parkinson's. And finally, I have convinced her to read some of the poems that she has written. And so that's going to be quite a treat. I've seen and read her poems and her writing on her website, and they are truly delightful. And so she's going to read some of her poems. So put it on your calendar. We'll have this listed on the teleseminar page here in just an hour or so. 12 o'clock Monday, this coming Monday, Pacific time, and 3 o'clock on Eastern time. And that is what's happening at Parkinson's Recovery on the shores of the Puget Sound, where all the men are handsome, all the women are smart, and all the children are loved. Know that all of you who are listening are on the road to recovery. Good day.
Bye-bye. Anybody still on?